Today's Teisho will be on case 33 in the Heikigan Roku, the Pien Lu, the Blue Rock Collection. Case 33. Chinsho Shosho comes to visit Shifuku. Engo's introduction. He does not distinguish east from west, north from south, from morning to evening, from evening to morning, so he remains. Can he be called asleep? Sometimes his eyes are like shooting stars. Can we call him wide awake? Sometimes he points to the south, calling it the north. Tell me, is he mindful or mindless? Is he a person of enlightenment or mediocrity? If you thoroughly understand this topic and know the secret of it, you will realize how the ancient masters went this way and that. Tell me, what season of life is this? See the following. Main subject. Chinsho came to see Shifuku. Shifuku drew a circle in the air. Chinsho said, I have no object in coming here. Why do you bother to draw a circle? Shifuku closed the door of his room. Setsho says, Chinsho has only one eye. Setsho's verse, perfect the circle, pure the sound, bright and abundant, the encircling jade, loaded on horses and mules, loaded on board the iron boats, given to those who know the peace and freedom of land and sea. He put down the tackle to fish the turtle. Setsho comments here, monks throughout the world can't jump out of it. We're in the heart of winter, really. This is the coldest part of the year here in New Jersey, and it's probably about 20 degrees outside right now, maybe even colder. It was 15 degrees, according to the bank, on Stelton Avenue this morning. And as I was driving here, I was thinking about another time, just about this point in the year, when it was very cold also. After I finished college, I got in touch with a friend of mine, Larry Sullivan. He was a friend of mine from college, and he was from Washington, D.C. And we met, I guess, the first year of college. And we became friends, and he had grown up in Fairfax, Virginia. And he was not very athletic. He was sort of a city boy, or suburban boy, if there's such a thing. And he had never been hiking, and I had gotten interested in hiking. And so we went hiking together, and his first hike was really like a nightmare for him. He had just never done anything like this. He had grown up in the suburbs of Washington, D.C. His dad was like a government bureaucrat, and Larry wasn't very athletic. He didn't he didn't play sports in high school or anything like that. And probably the most exercise he ever got was mowing the lawn once a week. He probably hadn't walked, 5 miles in his life, really. My father was transferred to the Washington, D.C. area, and we lived in an apartment not far from Larry's house one summer. And anyway, I went to visit him, and he told me his parents were away and he was having a wonderful time while they were gone. And I looked in the backyard and he would just sit in the lawn chair all day and drink beers and throw the cans in the grass. And that was his idea of a good time. And before his parents came back, he was going to clean them all up. There were like 50 cans. So anyway, I asked him if he'd like to go hiking, and I actually asked him if he wanted to go on a 50-mile hike. This really happened, Larry. By the way, today Larry Sullivan could hike until I begged for mercy. He's like an incredible outdoors person. I mean, he's been all over America. He sends me photos of himself. He's tough as nails now, you know. But he wasn't back then. He was just the way I'm describing him. He was sort of like pudgy guy. His idea, he listened to rock music all day, and his idea of a wild time was to throw beer cans on the lawn. And he liked to smoke dope too, so that completed the picture. So we went. He didn't know anything about hiking, so I helped him pick out a backpack and some boots and a few things like that, and a tent. And we went up on the Appalachian Trail and we went hiking. And for him, it was like a nightmare. It was just an extraordinary, horrible experience in every possible way. Basically, as I said, he'd never walked more than, I don't know, probably a couple miles. And our goal was to do 10 or 12 miles a day. And if you want to do 10 or 12 miles a day, you have to get up really early. You have to get up like when the sun comes up. You want to hit the trail early so you can cover some miles before it gets too hot. And then, if you you can actually like have lunch and rest, maybe take a little nap, and then you can hike again in the afternoon after 2 o'clock when it's not so hot. And it's easy to cover, say, 10 or 12 miles if you do it this way. And I had learned this from other people who were very avid hikers. But Larry was the kind of guy who got up at the crack of noon, And it was just a nightmare for him. We got up very early. He was groggy, and we had make a meal. We had I don't know if they even make it anymore. It was called instant breakfast, and it was like a powdered stuff that you put in. It included powdered milk. You just put it in water, heated the water, and it was supposed to be like what the astronauts ate. So. Anyway, we both had powdered breakfast, and then we hit the trail. And of course, he had all of these typical first-time hiker problems. So, his pack was too heavy for him. He brought too much stuff. He brought like candy and lots of snacks, and so it was just very, very heavy for him. And his shoulders hurt. He began to get sores. On his shoulders, and he had all kinds of blisters on his feet, he was in a lot of pain, actually. And if you go hiking like that, you don't bathe for 50-mile hike, you don't bathe for 7 days. You wash your face, you try to keep clean, but And you know, your constant companion are bugs, and anyway, it was just a nightmare for him. And he almost quit a couple times, and I think he would have quit, except we were so far, he got so far back away from the roads that there was no easy way to get out of the situation. And I could see, you know, his face was like a study in misery, you know, a lot of the time. After that was over, school started, this was one summer while we were in college, and we went back to school, and the interesting thing was that something about this experience really, really stuck with him, and he, next summer, approached me, and we started going hiking for like weekends because we were both working a construction job or construction jobs, and but we would get together on the weekend and go hiking, and at the end of that summer we also did a hike. And we started to hike together in college, and Larry really began to love it. You know, even though it had been this horrible, horrible experience. And I remember when we were like seniors in high school, seniors in college, he invited one of his friends to go hiking with him on the weekend, a guy named Chuck. And I remember Larry just laughing and laughing. I said, how did it go with Chuck? And Larry said, oh boy, was he ever green, you know. He was miserable the whole time, you know. It sounded like him, you know, 4 years ago. So anyway, Larry and I did a lot of hiking together in college. And then after college, we agreed to meet in Albuquerque, New Mexico. And came down from Seattle, and Larry came from Washington, D.C. And I used to do a lot of hitchhiking, so I hitchhiked to Albuquerque from Seattle. And hitchhiking isn't done anymore, but it was a very romantic way to travel if you had no money. You know, instead of taking a bus, it used to be possible to just stand out at an entry ramp to the interstate and stick out your thumb, and you might get a ride. So I started in Seattle, and I got a ride on Route 80 all the way to Montana, like in one day. And then from Montana, I hiked down through, part of Wyoming, and Colorado into Albuquerque, New Mexico, and it took me about 5 days. You know, hitchhiking is a strange thing because you can't control any of the process. You can get up, you have to get up early, you get by the side of the road, and you just wait, hoping somebody will pick you up, and you might sit there for 5 hours and then get a ride that'll take you 20 miles. Or you might sit there for 5 hours and you might get a ride that takes you, 300 miles. So very chancy and hard to control. And so we agreed to meet in Albuquerque roughly at a certain time. And Larry gave me his address in Albuquerque. He was staying with some friends out there in an apartment. And I had a street address. And I remember it was about this time of the year, and I got into town very late, like 10 or 11 at night. And the person who gave me a ride dropped me off in the center of Albuquerque. And I asked people where this street was, and I hitchhiked down the main street of Albuquerque at 10 or 11 at night. It was freezing cold. And somehow, you know, I was wandering around Albuquerque at 10 or 11 at night, in the middle of the winter, and sooner or later I actually found this apartment. That's to me, that I just don't know how I did it, you know. Well, anyway, I really enjoyed this experience, believe it or not. You know, there's something a little terrifying about hitchhiking, because you really can't control anything. You can't make sure, you can't promise somebody you'll be there on a certain day. You don't know how long you'll travel that day. You know, I have to tell you, hitchhiking is no longer safe, but back in the 70s, it was a pretty safe way for young men to travel. And sometimes I would sleep actually like at rest stops, you know, like highway rest stops. Behind the rest stop, I'd pitch a tent, or on one occasion, a couple occasions, I slept under, you know, like bridges on the interstate. I really wouldn't recommend this, but you know, it was a little bit frightening, but it was also very beautiful, and really, because I really was sort of open. I was going to get to Albuquerque at a certain time, you know, roughly speaking, and I didn't exactly know how I'd get there. You know, it might be Route 80, might go through Wyoming, might go through, you know, there are several different ways to get to Albuquerque. And you meet interesting people, but there's a high degree of, like, the unknown in this process, you know? And so, you know, I got into Albuquerque, and it was freezing cold, and it was late at night, or pretty late, and I didn't know where I was supposed to go, but I actually found this apartment. And, you know, in an earlier period in my life, I guess, if somebody had said, you're going to be in a strange city at 11 at night, and you'll have a street address, and you'll be walking around in the dark looking for the street address, that would have terrified me, you know. But little by little, it was like step by step, I had gotten used to this whole process, you know. And it was something so beautiful about it, because I was wandering around in Albuquerque, and it had snowed, you know, so there was snow on the ground. And the stars, even in Albuquerque at that time, the city has probably doubled in population. But it was really not a very large city at that time, and you could see a lot of the stars even in the middle of the city. And the whole experience was just, it could have been terrifying, but it was wonderful. And then anyway, Larry and I got summer jobs, or got jobs until the summer. And I worked in a restaurant for a number of months. And then when June came, we had enough money to live off our earnings. And we spent the whole summer backpacking. It was a wonderful way to live, you know. We had a map of the Southwest, and we had picked some of the major parks, you know. And there are some beautiful, huge parks out west. One of them is called the Bandelier, and it's north of Santa Fe, and it's filled with the ancient cities of Indians who live there. And they're abandoned now, but they built not really like our cities, but large villages, you know. And the villages are still there. Nobody lives there. And you can go hiking in beautiful country and come across one of these abandoned villages. And it's very beautiful. And that was one of the parks. And another park we went to is called Pecos Wilderness. And it's very high mountains. And beautiful lakes and huge mountains, and there's elk up in the mountains, and deer, and mountain lions, and porcupines. Anyway, we worked from about this time of year So February, March, April, May. And then in June, we had enough money. We both saved about $1,000. And we went backpacking. And we just got out on the highway, and we went north. And it turned out we got a ride first to the Pecos. And we, you know, got dropped off in front of a ShopRite type store, and we loaded up our backpacks with whatever we could buy, and we went up into the mountains until we ran out of food, you know. And we hiked and hiked. We didn't really know where we were going. Again, you know, that could be terrifying, right? It could be frightening. But there's something special or something wonderful about not exactly knowing where you're going, or not exactly having a plan. It gives, I don't know how to describe it, but I'm sure something like that has happened to you, where, you know, we generally try to map things out. You know, if we're going to a park like the Pecos Wilderness, we might want to have some topographical maps. You know, we might want to have other kinds of information, and we might want to plan out our whole journey. But sometimes not doing those things can be very powerful, very rich, a very rich experience, you know. And at first it can be frightening. You know, the first time I ever hitchhiked, I have to tell you the truth, it was so nerve-wracking that I actually cried at the end of the day, you know, because I had never hitchhiked before, and it was just very frightening to me, you know. I started hitchhiking in college, actually, and I went to school at a town called Charlottesville, and my father worked in Washington, D.C. And I found it very nerve-wracking to, like, stand by a road and have people reject me all day, you know. You smile and you stick your hand out and they drive by, and it might be hours. If you like things to happen when you like them to happen, it's actually very frustrating to hitchhike, you know, because you can't control the situation. And I was very much like that. It made me very nervous at first not to be able to control the situation. You know, all through high school, I was like a very hard-working, top student. And my life was very tightly organized. And I pretty much was constantly taking tests and getting good grades, or writing papers and getting good grades. And when I started hitchhiking, it was very offensive or frightening in some way, because I had to learn how to experience life without, like, a plan, you know. And it was frightening, and it made, as I say, you know, it was nerve-wracking. Getting into cars with complete strangers wasn't really that easy for me. And I would be nervous, you know, about what was going to happen in the car. And then you'd get dropped off, like, in the middle of nowhere. You know, so if you're going from Charlottesville to D.C., somebody might just be going, he might have a house out in a place, little town like Warrenton, Virginia. So he lets you off, and now you're in the middle of nowhere. And you might be there all day, you know. And so, if you're used to having everything happen according to plan, you sit there by the side of the road, and you can be very tense and nervous, you know. As I was, you know, many times. But there was something about the experience of traveling this way that I found, even in spite of myself, you know, very energizing, and I felt very open, even though it, as I say, the first time I did it, I actually cried at the end of the day. I was so stressed out. I began to enjoy hitchhiking. After a while, I was quite relaxed at this process, you know. It would be like, oh, well, you know, if I don't get a ride in 5 hours, I don't get a ride in 5 hours. And if you're standing by the road waiting for a ride, you know, you notice all kinds of things that you wouldn't notice if you were in your car. You could, you know, I would see animals, I would see birds, I would sit and look at the horizon and notice the way the colors changed. It sounds maybe not very interesting, but it was very interesting. And there was something about the openness of the whole process, you know, that that I loved. And when Larry and I got together to do our plan, make our plan come true of hiking, you know, we just hiked from park to park, and we just started exploring. And sometimes we would have accidents, like when we were in the Pecos Wilderness, to our surprise, even though it was June, there were big snowdrifts on the trail. And I remember stepping into a snowdrift, and when I pulled my foot out, the sole had torn right off my shoe. So I had to find the sole down there in the snow and, you know, tie it up, like tie the sole back onto the shoe with extra shoelaces. We had to hike down to Santa Fe, and I had to buy some new shoes, you know. But there was something about that experience that was so wonderful. That summer was such a great experience. You know. Well, anyway, what does this have to do with the koan? You know, this koan is about Jinsho. Jinsho is like he imagines himself to be like very far advanced Zen student, and he comes to see a very famous Zen master named Shifuku. And when Jinsho comes in the room, Shifuku drew a circle in the air. Well, you know, this koan is about you know, how we might choose to live our lives. You might have noticed that Zen is very free from what you could call traditional sorts of religious iconography and ritual, you know? So we don't have, say, any pictures on the altar. We don't really have, like, we recite sutras, but you know, actually, if you read the sutras, they're most of them are just rather, first of all, they're not comprehensible in English, but also if you read them, they're pretty philosophical, you know. Form is emptiness, emptiness is form, it's this kind of thing, you know. Zen seems to be missing a lot of the characteristics of, like, traditional religion. So you know, we do bows before we meditate and after we meditate, and the sutras and the bows, and we light incense. That's about it, you know. And that's quite typical of Zen. You know, if you were to study in a different tradition, it might be quite different. You know, so. Some of you, I know, have been involved in, like, Tibetan tradition. And the Tibetan tradition is so different from Zen. You know, it's beautiful, but it's very different, you know. I myself have never studied the Tibetan path, but one of my teachers, my second teacher, Webb, was quite involved with Tibetan Buddhism at one time, and he had quite a lot of friends, even in Dharamsala. He had, in fact, there was a man who was a teacher to the Dalai Lama, teacher of the Dalai Lama, named Geshe Darge, who at one time lived in Seattle and used to come and sit at our Zen center, and he, because he was a friend of Webb. And, you know, my impression of Tibetan Buddhism might not be that well informed, but it's very devotional, you know. So there's people do a lot of bows, and there's a lot of pictures, you know. All, like, if you go into a Tibetan temple, there's a lot of deities and the saints, and different when you're doing your Zen pra- your sorry, your meditation practice, you know, it might involve prayer, a lot of prayer. Rituals, very important, and in Tibetan Buddhism you have lots of rituals, you know. And also, as I mentioned, you have like saints and deities, and you even associate yourself with the deities. Some forms of Tibetan meditation involve worship of a deity, also identification with the deity. And all of this, it looks like a traditional religion, you know. You might be used to something more like this, you know, where basically there's a lot of ritual, a lot of pictures, a lot of images, a lot of devotion, and a lot of scriptural study. You know, especially the Dalai Lama's sect, you know, they do a lot of study. So there's just quite a bit of attention to teachings. You know, Zen is very different from that. I'm unusual in a lot of ways because I give people a lot of instructions. And typical Zen approach is just to you come into the Zendo for the first time, somebody basically shows you the rudiments of how to sit on the cushion, and might say, you know, watch your breath, and that's it. And you sit on the cushion, and if you've had rudimentary instruction, you know, you might not know what you're doing at all. And even if somebody tells you, you know, I'm sort of unusual because I give people more detailed instructions than many teachers do. But even if you have some detailed instructions, there's a lot of uncertainty in the process, you know. It's a little bit like standing by the side of the road and waiting for something to happen. There's a wonderful book called The Wooden Bowl. It's by a man named Clark Strand. And Clark Strand started sitting with a Chinese teacher somewhere, I think it was in either Tennessee or Kentucky. He was going to a university there, and he heard about a Chinese Buddhist monk who was living strangely in the middle of nowhere in this little house in, like, Kentucky. And he went to see the monk, and the monk spoke a little bit of English. And he said the monk never gave him any actual instruction. He said, I would like to meditate, and so the monk sat down with him, and they had some cushions, and the monk just started meditating. And Clark Strand just sat there for a while thinking, well, now what do I do? And after a while, he tried to adjust his posture to look a little bit like the monk. And he said, that's all the instruction I ever got from this guy. And strangely, Strand kept going back, and he kept going back, and he kept going back. And the teacher never gave him any lessons, never gave him any guidance. But for some reason, Strand kept coming back. You know, years later, he went to study with Eido Roshi in Daibosatsu. And he studied with Eido Roshi for like 10 years or something. And after his training was more or less complete, he said, I realized that, you know, Eido Roshi had been a wonderful teacher, but I realized the best Zen teacher was this Chinese monk who didn't tell me anything. Now, maybe that's too extreme. I think modern people need a little more guidance than that. But there's something very pure about not having that guidance, not having that map. It makes us very nervous, right? It makes us very nervous. But there's something beautiful about encountering the world without the map. And in fact, you know, the map is often like a big problem for us. You know, we all have like maps. We all have like maps. You know, people get nervous if their lives deviate from, like, the quote-unquote, the norm. You know, we all do. And we're always trying to be where we're supposed to be, or we're always trying to have the experience we think we should have. You know, this is so typical, isn't it? So, you know, you might be a few years older than other people in college, you know. And this might actually cause you a lot of suffering. You might be worried that you're a little too old, you know. Or you might take an extra year to finish your degree, you know, so, you know, you're supposed to finish in 4 years and you might finish in five. Or, you know, some little deviation like that might cause like a lot of anxiety. It's very interesting. But every once in a while, you know, we overcome our anxiety, or if we want to overcome our anxiety, we put up with a little bit of uncertainty, you know, not knowing. And life can seem so rich. It can be such a beautiful experience. So, you know, one way to think about Zen is that the style of Zen, or the method of Zen, is actually not having a map. You know? It's not having a map. This is so important because people think they have to have a map. You know, we create these maps to protect us and to reassure ourselves. But, you know, the maps cause a lot of anxiety, too, because, you know, you don't always wind up where you're supposed to be. You sometimes wind up at places that aren't on the map, you know. And that can cause, like, a lot of suffering or a lot of fear and anxiety. Or it can create this beautiful, deep sense of connection to things. So every, you know, the Tibetan tradition has its own beauties. They're really beautiful. It's really wonderful. As you go into a Tibetan temple, there's all these saints, beautiful. They have really good colors. You know, in Zen, we don't have good colors. You know, our cushions are black. The robes are blue. That's it, you know. Tibetans, it's like the robes are yellow and red. And beautiful colors, peach, you know, great. They have great colors. You know. And this, the path is very rich with the symbolism, and it's very rich with ideas, symbols, images, very complicated. And so, like, it's like very beautiful embroidery, you know. But Zen is like different. The method of Zen is like not is to like taking away the map. It's like you're throwing away the map, you know, and we don't like to do that, but it's a beautiful way to live. And really, the from the Zen standpoint, you know, the problem is the map. You know, we have an idea of what's supposed to be the case, what's supposed to happen, who we're supposed to be. You know, I'm supposed to be this. And then when it turns out I'm not this, you know, I get afraid or unhappy, even if it's uncontrollable, right? It's like, you know, when I would hitchhike, I couldn't say to my friends, I'll be in Albuquerque in 3 days. It's uncontrollable. You know, you just have to, I'll get to Albuquerque when I get there, you know. Well, Zen is a lot like that, you know. It's more important to be out on the road and it's like more important to be going. You'll figure it out. You know, you'll figure it out. And really going is the most important thing. You know, the destination is actually a kind of fantasy. It's really going that matters. And it's how you go. You know, so you can be, you know, nervous, fearful, frightened, angry. You know, those are all possible ways of hitchhiking, you know. You can be like a compulsive person. I've got to get X number of miles down every day. You can go out into the wilderness with your map, but it kind of defeats the purpose of being in the wilderness, doesn't it? It's like we get away from the roads, we get away from the schedule, but then we bring a road and we bring a schedule. You know, there's something beautiful about not having a map, you know, not having a timetable. You just start walking. You know, I wonder where this trail goes. Now, I've done that so many times in my life. You know, I wonder where. You've got about 7 days worth of food, and you say, "I wonder where this trail goes." You know, And you just keep walking until you're almost halfway out of your food, and then you have to turn back, you know. And sometimes it's hard to remember where you started, you know. But it's not the, you know, it's not the end of the world, you know. I remember getting lost once, and I was really down to like eating, you know, all I had left in my pack was like powdered milk. So I had some macaroni left and some powdered milk. And but you know, and it was awful, really, food. And I really did start thinking, well, maybe I can eat some. I wonder what's edible here, you know, like acorns and things like that. But I did get out, you know. I did get out. I ran into some guy and said, "How do I get out of here?" And he told me how to get out. But it's risky, you know. But still, it was so exciting, you know. When you don't have the map, being alive can be so beautiful. So you know, the Zen practice, you know, I think my teacher Webb used to say this, you know, the Tibetan tradition is this beautiful like embroidery. You know, they give you this and you work with it. They give you this and you work with it. They give you this. Zen is like taking away. The method of Zen is like taking away, throwing away the map, you know. Just taking, constantly taking away. And we're a little bit afraid to like encounter things without like a plan or a schedule or like a guide. Even the moment can be unnerving if you don't know what you're supposed to be doing with it, you know? I remember the reason I got interested in hiking was because my dad wanted to be involved with the Boy Scouts. Some of his friends on the base where we were living were involved with scouting, and so my father wanted to get involved with the Boy Scouts. And when I was very little, when I was like 11, I went on a 50-mile hike. And my father was a very heavy-set guy. He probably weighed 100 pounds more than I do. And he used to smoke cigars. And he almost had a heart attack on the hike. Anyway, I got sick on that hike, and I had to stay behind. And my father was so happy not to keep hiking. He said, "I have to stay with Kurt." And on the Appalachian Trail, we have they're like cabins. You can they have an open front. So we stayed in one of these hiking cabins, and my father did fall. My father grew up in New Jersey. My father is from Elizabeth, New Jersey. But he fell in love with the wilderness. This was like his first hike, and it was really rough on him physically and everything. And we were stuck in this cabin, and everybody else went on, and we stayed behind because I was sick. I really got some bug from the water or something, and I had a fever and everything. And I remember my father there was a table in front of the cabin, and I remember watching my dad, and if he didn't have something to do, he just went crazy, right? He would start smoking compulsively, and he didn't only smoke cigars, he also smoked cigarettes. And my father was just feverishly smoking away, and he, you know, got all his gear out of his backpack and went through it all and put it all back, and that was my dad. He didn't know how to deal with like empty time, you know. He wanted to have a purpose or a goal, and when it wasn't there, he didn't know what to do. He didn't know just how to like be in the moment. It was hard, very hard for him. He didn't know how to be in the moment. And I remember watching him and realizing, even as a little kid, how nervous he was, you know, and how he was unnerved by just sitting on this mountaintop in Virginia on a beautiful summer day, you know. You sit on the cushion. Today you got up and you came here to practice. And you might have had all kinds of expectations about what was going to happen. You sit on the cushion and you watch your breath. And then, you know, it's just like hitchhiking. You don't know what's going to happen. You can't make it happen. You're in the moment. And if you stay there long enough, it sort of wears out all your plans, your expectations, and your maps. And you have to learn how to be in that state. And that state is really great. If you stay there long enough, you just feel so alive and so wonderful. It's the same thing as hitchhiking on the road. You know, when I first started doing it, it was so nerve-wracking. I would get so upset. I would think, my God, I've been here for 4 hours, you know, and it would make me so mad, you know. Now, you know, but there was something, you know, I didn't stop doing it, which is the strange thing, you know. I could have just taken a bus, you know, which is not a very nice experience, in my opinion. But I would have gotten there predictably, right? But even though part of me, like my little mind, was telling me, this is crazy, 4 hours, this is a waste, you know, it was just the uncontrollability of it, you know. It was frustrating. I got angry sometimes. But there was another part of my brain that really loved this, you know. It was like life with no goal, you know, life with no goal. And, you know, our goals, if you think about it, you know, we create all these goals, but many of them are really just crazy. They really don't serve any purpose at all, you know, really. I mean, so much of what humans do is just totally unnecessary. And every once in a while, you know, we realize that, you know, and it could be a little scary, but you know, so many things are just if you think of all the things we've invented in the 20th century that are like useless and unnecessary. Some things are good, you know, but so many of the things we've created really aren't needed. We really don't need them, you know. We could live much simpler lives if we had fewer expectations, you know. And when we don't always have all these things, you know, it's amazing how rich and beautiful life can be. So this koan is really about, you know, we constantly want to make a map. We constantly want a structure, and yet. It, you know, really, reality is beyond words. It's beyond concepts. It's real. It's real. But it's beyond words. It's beyond concepts. It's beyond culture, you know. And Zen is all about, like, experiencing, getting through all of that, working through all of that, and just being present in the moment. And so, you know, you sit on the cushion and you might expect this to happen and it doesn't. And you can get mad, you can be disappointed, you can be... But, you know, if you've been coming to practice for a while, there's something about... There's part of you that says, I love this experience. And you might not be able to put your finger on it. But I think it has to do with that encountering the world without maps. It's really encountering the real. The maps are artificial, right? The world is real. You know, human, Homo sapiens are about 100,000 years old. Yeah. And I was reading the other day about a species that's been on Earth for 250 million years. Isn't that amazing? 250 million years. And I thought, you know, basically, I would be amazed if Homo sapiens lasted 250,000 years. Yeah? We Homo sapiens, you know, we create like this artificial world. But we know we're here and we're gone, you know, as individuals, as species. The world, there's something here that's more real than our ideas, it's more real than our concepts and our culture. And it's actually, as it turns out, it's actually just wonderful. So anyway, everybody came here to sit today, and we may have been drawing circles in the air, you know. But every once in a while, we stop doing it. And we just are sitting on the cushion and hearing the sound of a fan, or noticing how beautiful it is to breathe. Or the mind is simply resting serenely in the moment. And you might suddenly feel so wonderfully alive. And that sense of being alive can get deeper and deeper and deeper. And that's really what we're up to. So thank you for coming here today. And I hope we can do this on and on and on for a long time.